I want you to turn with me to the second chapter of Malachi. Now, we're almost through our study of the minor prophets. I would like to have you do some thinking. I don't know whether I'll finish Malachi today or not, but I wish you would suggest to me something you'd like to study. If you have some favorite part of it, I'd like for it to be in the Old Testament. I'd like to, since I'm preaching Sunday morning and Sunday night from the New, I would like for us to have one of our studies from the Old Testament. This will conclude our study of the minor prophets. I don't think we've ever studied Isaiah. If you want to go into that, it'll be an excellent study. It's one of the truly great books of the Bible. Yes, sir. Sir? Yes? Yeah, thank you. Thank you for calling me again the other day. And if you, it's a long book. That's the problem. It's a long book, but I would just try to sum of it. I'll try to just give you the idea of it and go into detail on the rest of it. But if you'd like to study it, we will. If not, why suggest something else. Whatever you want to study, I'd be glad to deal with. If you want a subject, I'll deal with that. But I would appreciate a suggestion from you, and if I don't do what you suggest, don't feel bad about it, because I'll try to accommodate the most of the group. But let's turn now to our lesson in Malachi. This comes, of course, to the conclusion not only of our study of the minor prophets, but also of the Old Testament. Now, Malachi, as I said last Sunday morning, is different from any other of the prophets in that it's primarily a question and answer type of teaching. Malachi puts a question in the mouth of his audience, then he answers that question. And they'll ask a question, or rather, he puts it in their mouth. I don't think they actually ask it, but he puts it in their mouth, because this is what they're saying. This is the way they're feeling. So he puts it in the form of a question, then he responds to it. Now, in the first five verses, he pointed out God's love for Jacob over Esau. Then he turns to the priest and condemns or rebukes the priest for their indifference toward the sacrifices that they're allowing the people to offer. They'll let them bring the sick or the lame or the blind and offer that as a sacrifice. Well, he said, offer to your governor. See what he'll do about it. Well, the governor wouldn't have had it either. That was an insult to God to offer him what they were offering. We can get a lesson from that. I think it's an insult to God when we don't offer him the very best of our life, the best of our service, the best of everything we've got. Our contribution or anything else, whatever it might be, we ought to represent something that relates us to God and our respect for him. So he rebukes those priests for that. Now, and then it comes down to that conduct and that breaking the covenant of Levi. But I was down to verse 9 last Sunday, and now let's look at verse 10. Now, in verse 10, he now introduced a second aspect of his rebuke of the people. That is, they were putting away their wives and marrying foreign women. Now, this, I think, is a very important passage in the Old Testament in its relation to certain aspects of marriage. But I think before, I want to read it first. Then I want to go back and show the background of what they were doing that he was dealing with. So let's read, beginning with verse 10. Have we not all one Father? Hath not one God created us? Why do we deal treacherously, every man against his brother, profaning the covenant of our fathers? That was a covenant made at Mount Sinai, recorded in Exodus 19 and also in the 24th chapter, verses 1 to 8, where the covenant was actually dealt with. Now, Judah hath dealt treacherously, and an abomination is committed in Israel and in Jerusalem, for Judah hath profaned the holiness of Jehovah, which he loveth, that is, which God loves, and hath married the daughter of a foreign god. Well, that means she was married, she was an idolatress. She was a worshiper of idols. What he meant there, Jehovah will cut off to the man that doeth this, him that waketh and him that answereth out of the tents of Jacob, and him that offereth an offering unto Jehovah of hosts. Try to cut him off, that person off. Now we'll look at it in detail in a moment. And this again you do. You cover the altar of Jehovah with tears and weeping and with sighing, insomuch that he regarded not the offering any more, neither received it with goodwill at your hand. Yet you say, wherefore? Why? Why did God not accept it? Not answer, because Jehovah had been witness between thee and the wife of thy youth, against whom thou hast dealt treacherously, though she is thy companion and the wife of thy covenant. That's the point I want to note and stress in a moment. The wife of thy covenant. And did he not make one, although he had the residue of the Spirit? Therefore one. He sought a godly seed. Therefore take heed to your spirit, and let none deal treacherously against the wife of his youth. Now the first part of that verse doesn't make very much sense to me as it's translated here. But I'll give you two or three other translations in a moment that I think are far better. Right now then, moving on. For I hate putting away, saith Jehovah, the God of Israel, and him that covereth his garment with violence, saith Jehovah of hosts. Therefore take heed unto yourselves, unto your spirit, that you deal not treacherously. Now, in order to understand this, we need to go back and get the background of it. First of all, what was the Lord's law concerning marrying foreigners or aliens by the Israelites? Turn to the 34th chapter of the book of Exodus, and notice what it says in verse 15 and 16. I'm going to give you time to find that, because I want you to note these two passages, one in Exodus, one in Deuteronomy. Now, notice it says here, and when you come, God's a jealous God, lest thou make a covenant with the inhabitants of the land, and they play the harlot after their gods, and sacrifice unto their gods, and one call thee, and thou eat of his sacrifice. Now, verse 16, and look carefully also that thou take of their daughters unto thy sons, and thy daughters play the harlot after their gods, and make thy sons play the harlot after their gods. What? Right? Here they were forbidden to marry, intermarry with the people of Canaan into the land which they were coming. These worshippers of idols. But when you marry this idolater or idolatress, that will lead you into idolatry and away from God. Now then, look at Deuteronomy, the 7th chapter. I believe it's chapter 7 in verse 3. I believe that's the one I'm looking for. Or maybe 3 verse 7 now. Forget that now. All right. Yeah, 7:3. Deuteronomy 7:3. Now he says, neither shalt thou make marriages with them, that is the people of Canaan, which you're entering. We started up here in verse 1. Take heed, neither shalt thou make marriages with them. Thy daughters thou shalt not give unto his son, neither his daughter shalt thou take unto thy son, for he will turn away thy son from following me, that they may serve other gods. Now this is exactly what happened to Solomon. We'll look at that in just a moment. All right, now here then was the law. You're not to marry these foreigners, these idolaters, into whose land you go. Now, turn with me to Ezra, and let's notice the background of the particular thing that we're looking at right now. Well, here in Ezra, the 10th chapter, in Ezra 10, Ezra was dealing with this very thing here. They were intermarrying when they came back. Now they come back from Babylon. We've been dealing with that. They came back from Babylon in 536. Right? They did not build a temple immediately, but 20 years later, they finished it in 516. They didn't work on it for 16 years. In 520 to 516, they completed the temple. Right? Now that's 516 now. Now we come down to 458. Ezra came over in 458. I guess, yes, 458. So that would be from 560, be about 60 years later, wouldn't it? It came in about 60 years later. All right, now here the condition we're dealing with now are the conditions that existed in Malachi day. Now Ezra came in 558. Nehemiah came in 444-5 and continued to be governor until about 432. Malachi prophesied from about 445 to about 432. he was contemporary with Nehemiah. Right now, I turn to Nehemiah 13, and we'll notice now what Nehemiah said about this. Notice here in verse 23. In those days, the 13th chapter in verse 23. Right, now, wait a minute, let me go back here to verse 1 to 3. Now, Nehemiah read the law there, and look at verse 3. It came to pass, when they had heard the law, that they separated from Israel all the mixed multitude. That would be those who were not Israelites or true Israelites. Now then you have also intermarriage. Now look at verse 23. In those days also saw I the Jews that had married women of Ashdod, of Ammon, and of Moab. And their children spake half in the speech of Ashdod, and could not speak in the Jews' language, but according to the language of each people. And I contended with them, and cursed them, and smote certain of them, and plucked off their hair, and made them swear by God, saying, You shall not give your daughters unto their sons, nor take their daughters for your sons, or for yourself. Now notice, did not Solomon, king of Israel, sin by these things? Yet among many nations was there no king like him, and he was beloved of his God, and God made him king over all Israel. Nevertheless, even him did foreign women cause to sin. Right? So now shall we then hearken unto you in this thing here? So here you see what Malachi is talking about now. The men who had come back, or been born after they came back, one or the other, they were putting away their wives and marrying foreign women. And this is the thing God's condemning here and all that. Now, that's not to justify divorce. I'm not doing that. I'm simply saying that this particular passage is not one to which I could appeal personally, comfortably, on certain matters. I'm telling a person, if you've been married, now then, on the day of God, we've got to put away your wife. We've got brethren to go to this passage. I don't think that justifies that. This is dealing with the marriage of these individuals, led them into idolatry. Alright? So this is what he's talking about. But there is a principle laid down in Malachi that I do want you to get. And that is that they had violated the marriage covenant. And this is the thing, and this is, I think, one of the major things in divorce, is that the individual violates the covenant that individual made, and that was a very serious thing in the old covenant. Thou vowest to vow unto Jehovah, defer not to pay it. You have no pleasure in fools. Defer, pay thou with thou vowest. Right? So, and also against the Gentiles in Romans 1 and verse 30-31, they said to the Gentiles, they were covenant breakers. That would mean then that they didn't keep their covenants, and the Gentiles were never mentioned as far as a marriage is concerned, or divorce or remarriage. That isn't mentioned among them. But it said they were covenant breakers. So that, you see, was a moral sin against God, or a sin against God's moral law, to break a covenant here. All right, now let's turn to Malachi, and let's notice what he said. I want to start back here at verse 10 again. Have we not all one Father? Have not one God created us? And that one Father, of course, is God there. Why? Because back here in verse 6 he said, A son honoreth his father, and a servant his master. If then I am a father, back in verse chapter 1, verse 6, where is mine honor? And if I am a master, where is my fear, said Jehovah of hosts, unto you, O priests, that despise my name? So the father that he's talking about here is God the Father, and these are servants, the sons of God, children of God. And he said, Hath not one God created us? Why do we deal treacherously, every man against his brother, profaning the covenant of our fathers? Now that covenant of the fathers was a covenant made back in Exodus, the 24th chapter, which I've read a number of times. Well, notice now, let me just look at it now to see what we're, keep up with what we're talking about. Now, in 24:1 in Exodus, now here it says, now Moses came down about verse 3. Moses came down from the mount there and told the people all the words of Jehovah, all the ordinances, and all the people answered with one voice and said, All the words which Jehovah hath spoken will we do. Right? Now he read unto them the ordinances and the law that God gave them. Now they understood it. They said, All that Jehovah our God commanded will we do. Right? Now notice further. And Moses wrote all the words of Jehovah and rose up early in the morning and builded an altar under the mount and 12 pillars according to the 12 tribes of Israel. And he sent young men of the children of Israel who offered burnt offerings and sacrificed peace offerings of oxen unto Jehovah. That's before the Levitical priesthood had been appointed. And Moses took half of the blood and put it in basins, and half of the blood he sprinkled on the altar. And he took the book of the covenant, I know, and read, now go read it again now, and read it in the audience of the people, and they said, all that Jehovah has spoken will we do and be obedient. Now, that law of the covenant they're entering into contained that passage in Exodus, and the passage later written in Deuteronomy, which is based on Exodus. And so in this covenant then, there was an agreement that they would keep God's law. Well, that law said you shall not marry these foreigners, these idolaters here. Right, now that's what Malachi says. You have broken the covenant of the fathers. Covenant that bound them to God. Now look further here. Moses took the blood and sprinkled it on the people. And in Hebrews, the 9th chapter, the writer of Hebrews says, and upon the people, both the book and the people, saying, behold, the covenant God has made with you this day. Right? And said, behold, the blood of the covenant which Jehovah hath made with you concerning all these words. Right, now what I want to notice in our class, I think I've said this before, but I want to get in this connection here. That when God made this covenant, Moses read the words of the covenant in the hearing of the people. The people understood what God said. They agreed to it. They said, all that Jehovah commanded, will we do it, be obedient. Now that covenant contained the promises of God. It contained also the penalties, the promises of God, or the promises of God. Then it contained the penalties for the violation of it. So now they understood that. Here were promises that God would keep under conditions. Here they agreed to that, but here were also penalties in the 26th chapter of Leviticus and the 28th chapter of Deuteronomy. We ought to be familiar with those, and I think you are by now. I've mentioned them so many times. Now you have the blessings and the curse. Here are the blessings if you keep the law of God. Here are the curses if you don't keep the law of God. They agreed to that. So now they're in a covenant relationship with God. Of course, Leviticus was a part of that first part of the covenant. Deuteronomy was the summary of it. So now then, these people have now violated that covenant made with the fathers. Therefore then, what will happen? The penalties for the violation will be executed. And that's what he means about the curse here. So come back to this now. You profane the covenant of our fathers. Judah had dealt treacherously, and an abomination is committed in Israel and in Jerusalem. That's all just one people there. For Judah hath profaned the holiness of Jehovah, which God loves. That is, you should be unto me a holy nation. So they would be unto God a holy nation, holy people here, and in covenant with him there. But now then God loves holiness, but they didn't keep that. And so these individuals then, if they were to be a holy nation unto him, that I think was in Leviticus, in Exodus 19, somewhere on about that. But we're not going to which there. Let me just look at the mind. Here in this 19th chapter here, verse 4, you have seen 19 and 4, you have seen what I did to the Egyptians and how I bare you on eagle's wings and brought you unto myself. Now therefore, if you will obey my voice, indeed, and keep my covenant, then you shall be mine own possession from among all peoples. For all the earth is mine, you shall be unto me a kingdom, a priest, and a holy nation. All right, now notice that expression, a holy nation. These are the words which thou shalt speak unto the children of Israel. So they're going to be a holy people, and God loved holiness. They're holy people. Now they have violated that. So they violated this covenant that their fathers had made, which they were brought into by the circumcision of the males. When each male was 8 days old and circumcised, that brought him into the covenant relationship with God, made back yonder, don't you see? Now he's to keep that law. All right? So he moves on now. Jehovah had, but you dwelt there treacherously. I know what he goes on to end, which Jehovah loveth, that is holiness. Which Jehovah loved it, and had married the daughter of a fallen god. So you violated that law. Now this is what he's after now. Jehovah will cut off to the man that doeth this, him that waketh and him that answereth out of the tents of Jacob, and him that offereth an offering unto Jehovah of hosts. Now that's probably, most scholars think that's a proverb. That is, he will cut off everyone that speaks and those that wake out of the tent. In other words, here is the person who's going to get people awake, and he blows a horn or calls or whatever it is, and awakens those in the tent. So it simply means all individuals, those that call and those that respond. All of these God's going to cut off who have married these foreign women here. They put away their wives and married foreigners. And this again you do. You cover the altar of Jehovah with tears and weeping and with sighing, insomuch that he regardeth not the offering any more, neither receiveth it with goodwill at your hands. Now, there are divisions of ideas. One scholar in his book took the position that this means that they were so intense now in returning to God that they, and their weeping covered their sacrifice of the altar. I don't think that's so at all. I think what it is the tears of those wives. Those wives who had been mistreated, put away, rejected, in order to marry a younger woman of these nations, these Gentiles, heathen people there, that the tears of these women, not literally, but figuratively, or by metaphorically, they covered the fires of the altar to where the sacrifices would be burned, don't you see? Now, that wouldn't be literal. They wouldn't catch tears and go pour it on there. They wouldn't all stand over and weep there. But it's simply a strong figure of speech showing here that you have mistreated these women and their tears have so put out the fire of your sacrifices that God doesn't accept your sacrifices. And so really the sins that did it, you see, expressed in the tears of these women. I think that's the point that Malachi is making there. The other doesn't make sense to me, but this one does. All right? And so he said here, so God will not accept a sacrifice, a goodwill at your hand, with goodwill at your hand. So as long as they were living in that kind of sin, God would not accept the sacrifices. And so God still hates putting away. This is such a big question. So involved, and so many different views taken by so many of our brethren that if you tried to listen to them, you wouldn't know where you were. Study every scripture you can find. Make up your own mind on this now. That's what I've done. And they've said some hard things about me and all that. False teacher, all that. I know it doesn't bother me a bit in the world. But I think I've got the truth on it. At least I tried to do my own study on this. I came to my own conclusion. I didn't go to the brethren and say, what's the popular thing on this? Popularity didn't make any difference to my position. I'm popular. My position is that when an individual who has married and divorced and remarried out here in the world wants to obey the gospel, that God accepts those individuals and they start a new life. I baptize them. I don't know how many I'm doing, but I've kept count of them. I baptize several of them, sure, in life. Who are like that? Peter didn't raise that question on Pentecost. An apostle never raised it to the Gentiles. He never raised that question. So why should we raise it? Why should we argue the question of whether to baptize that person or not when God never legislated except, say, go preach the gospel and he that believes in the baptized shall be saved. If I accept that, I'll accept the confession of a believer and baptize him. So this is my position. And I haven't gone out and tried to crusade for it. I've only answered people when they came to me with a problem. Done this since the 1930s. It's when I began to open my eyes to this. And when the elders had decided not to accept a couple, he wanted to be restored. She wanted to be baptized, but one or the other had been divorced. I don't know which one had. And they said, no, you can't be a member here unless you're separate. Well, that started me to think. I'm glad God say that. I went to my Bible and tried to find what God said on it. I found God never said a word like that. Never said put them away. Now, can I come to this passage here? No. Well, these were Jews who had put away their wives and married foreign women and would lead them into idolatry. I'm not talking about two people who come and want to obey God and become Christians. All the difference in the world, isn't it? Seems to me there is. All right, so now, this is the problem. Now look a little further. Yet you say, why? Why don't you receive these sacrifices? Now, because Jehovah had been witness, God's response, because Jehovah had been witness between thee and the wife of thy youth, against whom thou hast dealt treacherously, though she is thy companion, and the wife of thy covenant. Right? So what is marriage? Marriage is a covenant entered into by two individuals. Here they cover. Sometimes we say, well, that marriage was made in heaven. No, it's not a marriage on earth, it's made in heaven. Marriages are made here on earth between a man and a woman there through covenant, or go enter into a covenant to live together as husband and wife. Now then what you do when you break that covenant, I mean when you separate, or when you divorce, rather, go marry someone, you've broken a covenant. The covenant's been broken. But like the Jews have broken a covenant with God for what they were doing, this individual breaks a covenant with the wife of his youth when he puts her away and marries another. And I think that's a point when in the, when Jesus said there, whosoever putteth away his wife and marrieth another except for fornication, committeth adultery, that the thing, the primary thing and consideration is that you've violated or broken a covenant there. Covenant you've made. I want you to study that. You study for yourself. Don't take it because I said, you go and say, well, let's see if that's so or not. Right? So here you're broken a covenant. Now this next verse, very difficult. I think the American Standard alternate reading is better, but I've got an even better one. And not one hath done so who had a residue of the Spirit, or what is there one that seeketh a godly seed? But I've got to hear a couple of the translation of the New King James and of the New International Version of both better. I like the New International better on. Here's what it says. It says, has not the Lord made them one? That would be husband and wife. And they did back in Genesis in Matthew 19. In flesh and spirit, they are his. And why one? Because he was seeking godly offspring. So guard yourselves in your spirit, and do not break faith with the wife of your youth. Well, that makes sense here, that God made them one. He was looking for a godly seed, a goodly seed, through which to populate the earth, and then his own people there. So guard yourselves against the spirit that would lead you to violate the covenant with your wife. Now that makes, I think that's what he's really saying there. Now here's the New King James. And did he make them one, having a remnant of the Spirit? And why one? He seeks godly offspring. Therefore, take heed to your spirit, and let none deal treacherously with the wife of his youth. Well, that makes sense. So either the New American Standard or the New International Version make more sense even than the alternate reading here in the American Standard. The American Standard, to me, doesn't make much sense. Now, read that again now. When he says, and did he not make one, although he had the residue of the Spirit? Who had the residue of the Spirit, and what were the point in that? I can't quite figure it out from this language here. And he said, he sought a godly, wherefore, one, he sought a godly seed. Now, that makes sense. Therefore, take heed to your spirit, and let none deal treacherously against the wife of his youth. So here's a covenant you've entered into. God seeks a godly offspring to inhabit the world here. And that goes clear back to Adam and Eve. That's why he made them like he did. He sought a godly seed, a seed that would respect God. Right? Now, why did he give this law to his own people? He wanted a godly seed through whom to bring the Messiah. Through which to bring the Messiah. So God has never intended that man should divorce and put away his wife and marry somebody. But now that raises the question. I know what God's will is. God's will is that they continue to be one and don't violate that covenant. I know that's it. But now that when people do, now what? See, that's the question. The real question faced is, what are you going to do with that person who has broken that covenant and now then got himself in a position there that he can't undo what he's done? They say, well, they ought to have to leave her and go back to the first one. Well, that's the very thing God forbade in Deuteronomy 24, when he said, if a man married a woman and finds some unseemly thing in her, and he puts her away and marries another, and she would put away and marry somebody, and he finds something, puts her away, she cannot go back to the first. For that, he says, were abomination with God. Right? So the brethren are asking people to do the very thing that God forbade them to do in the old covenant, and God doesn't change. He doesn't change. And so if he didn't like that then, he won't like it now. So you see, we've got a lot of studying to do on this. And to listen to every Tom, Dick, and Harry that comes along is a mistake. So I've quit reading what the brethren say about these things, what to say about me, what to say about this, because I'm going to do my own study. I think so far I'm on pretty good account. There's some passages, some things about the Christian and covenant relationship with God I'm not sure of. I don't think they can be sure of. It's difficult. I'm still studying on it. All right, now let me move on now. Now he goes on to say here, "For I hate putting away, saith Jehovah, the God of Israel, and him that covereth his garment with violence," that'd be by violently treating your wife, making her leave, or throwing her out, putting her away, "that therefore," saith Jehovah of hosts, "therefore take heed to your spirit, that you deal not treacherously." All right, now in the New Testament we have Paul's teaching in Ephesians, Colossians, and Peter in 1 Peter 3, of the relation of husband and wife, and these ought to be respected. The husband, it's a covenant, it's an agreement we enter into. The husband's to love his wife, the wife is subject to the husband. He's to treat her with this, not treacherously or violently or in a bad way in any way in the world, but always with consideration, with love, with tenderness, with affection. Where the husband treat his wife, the wife should be subject to him, and with that kind of a relationship, marriage can endure as long as the couple lives. Somebody said it's not a 50-50 deal, it's a 75-75 deal, and that's about right, a 90-90 deal. Each one goes 90% of it, and the other 90%, why, they get along fine. Well, one of them expects to do all the bossing and be the all that, and the other to be a slave, that's not going to work. Well, a wife may go ahead and tolerate it, think, well, God's going to give me a home in heaven because I feast did what he said in this respect. Where's the man going to wind up? He can turn it around the other way. Most of the preaching that our brethren have done that I've heard, why they spend more time on the wife being subject to the husband than they do on the husband to love his wife and to treat her like Jesus Christ treats the church. But that individual there, I don't know whether those were preachers in meetings that were quoting good dinners when they got through preaching, I don't know why, but we need to look at both sides of this thing, don't you see? Well, all right. Now that's what it says here. And so it's a violation of the covenant that was made there. God recognized the covenant, but the marriage is not made in heaven. The marriage is made here. Now, rather interesting that this lesson came where it did today. And my lesson in the 11th chapter of 2 Corinthians comes where it comes today. Both of them are dealing with a similar thought here. And it was interesting to me that they did that accidentally. It was a providence, and it wasn't what I planned to talk. All right, now let me move on. Now the 17th verse really is an introduction to the rest of the book. What are you going to say in the rest of the book? "Behold, I say, no, you have wearied Jehovah with your words. Yet you say, wherein have we wearied him? What have we done to weary God? Well, we burn these incense, these sacrifices. We're doing all right. We're doing our part. Wherein have we wearied him? In that you say, everyone that doeth evil is good in the sight of Jehovah, he that delighteth in them, and he delighteth in them. Or, where is the God of justice?" Take one or two extremes. Well, back, that's exactly what Isaiah said in the 5th chapter there. "Woe unto them that say that evil is good, and say that good is evil there." God pronounced a woe upon that. That's an individual that can't make a distinction between what's right and wrong, what's good and what's bad there. Well, God's people can, if they listen to what God said, being always distinguished what's right or wrong. Let me go back. This, God hates putting away. I did want to say two things about this. That is true. But God hates putting away. But I want you to note what God said about Judah in chapter 50 of Isaiah 15, verse 1 and 2 here. "Thus saith Jehovah, where is the bill of your mother's divorcement, wherewith I put her away? Or which of my creditors is it to whom I have sold you? Behold, for your iniquities were you sold, and for your transgressions was your mother put away." Who's the mother there? That's the nation. The nation is the mother. Now God didn't give, when he put away Judah in captivity, he did not give her a bill of divorcement. But now notice what he says here about Israel, the northern kingdom, in Jeremiah the 3rd chapter. Turn to that if you want, Will. Jeremiah the 3rd chapter. Now notice what he says here about verse 8, the third chapter of Jeremiah. "And I saw when for this very cause that backsliding Israel had committed adultery, I had put her away and given her a bill of divorcement. Yet treacherous Judah, her sister, feared not. Right? So he gave a writing divorce. Now, which of these did he take back when they brought him back? Probably Judah. You lose sight of the nation of Israel. You never read any more about the nation of Israel. That's wrong, because God put her away. He couldn't take them back. He violated his own law in Deuteronomy 24 if he had, but did not give. He didn't give Judah. Who are you on some passages? That's Jeremiah 3 in verse 8, yes. He gave them, her a writing of divorcement, but he didn't take her away. And now he said about Judah, where is the bill of divorcement that I gave to your mother? The one one. I didn't give her a bill of divorcement. So he took Judah back. Now any of the people of Israel who wanted to come back, they could come back with Judah. They could retain their tribal identity, all that. But they could not come back. They did not come back as a nation, as they went into captivity. See, Israel, the northern 10 tribes, went into Assyrian captivity. God said, I gave them a writing of divorce. But now then Judah was carried into that captivity, and that was a separation. He was separated from her, and Paul argued the difference between separation and divorce in 1 Corinthians 7. God's law didn't change on that. Still the same thing, only under different circumstances. So now then, since he did not give Judah a writing of divorcement, he took Judah back. See the difference there? And so take those two passages in the 50th chapter of Isaiah, chapter 50 and verse 1, and take Jeremiah, the third chapter, and verse 8, and then notice who was brought back. Judah was brought back. When he speaks of it being Israel, it was the covenant name there rather than Israel that went into captivity. I have a question on that. I do be glad for you to raise it, and I'll do the best I can with it. No question? Well, we'll move on then. We'll come on back to our lesson over here. Malachi. Now, I don't have time to do justice in this next one. I'm going to read it and say a word or two about it, and we'll look at it next Sunday. Behold, I send my messenger. He shall prepare the way before me, and the Lord whom ye seek will suddenly come to his temple. And the messenger of the covenant, messenger of the covenant, whom you desire, behold, he cometh, saith Jehovah of hosts. Who can abide the day of his coming? Now, in that verse there, behold, I send my messenger, he shall prepare the way before me. Now, who was that? That was John the Baptist. That's a quotation from Isaiah, the 40th chapter, here, and quoted by Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, all of them. And here he says that the voice of one, in verse 3, the voice of one that cried in the wilderness, pray the way of Jehovah, make his path straight, and so on there. Now this is the messenger that he's talking about. That's Isaiah 40 and verse 3. Well, now that's quoted in Matthew 1, Mark 1, Luke 1, and John. I forget maybe it's 1 or long thereabouts. It's quoted in all three passages, all three of them. So we know who that is. The messenger is John the Baptist. All right. Also, we know that further from Jesus. Now, Jesus twice said John the Baptist was the Elijah to come. Well, that really comes in a little later. I'm going to leave that right now. I'll wait till I get to the full chapter on that. Hold, I send my messenger, and he shall prepare the way set before me. All right. Now, here's the messenger and the me. Me is God coming in the person of Christ. And Moses says, and the Lord whom ye seek will suddenly come to his temple. So now here is the messenger, is John the Baptist, who heralds the way, and the Lord whom you seek is the Messiah. Now he's the one of the covenant, and the messenger of the covenant whom you desire to hold, he cometh, saith Jehovah of hosts. Now Jesus is the Lord, who is the messenger of the covenant. John the Baptist is the messenger that preceded Jesus and heralded his coming. So you've got two persons there. You've got John the Baptist, the messenger, and Jesus, the messenger of the covenant. Now when God says there that the Lord, the me, but he sent Jesus, the Lord, but he's the me, what does that do so far as identifying the deity of Christ or the relation of God, Christ to God? We got some brethren back in Kentucky that are spending their time, or at least whatever, most of their writing time, on trying to prove that Jesus laid aside his deity. When he came into the world, he laid aside his deity and was just a man. Therefore, as a man, he resisted sin, so as a man, you can live a sinless life also. Now, that theory grew out of the fact that they were teaching that man can live a sinless life. I don't argue what he can do, I argue what he does. He doesn't live a sinless life, so I don't know who's to argue the other question there. But in order to do that, they've got to make Jesus just a man. I want you to note here, God said, look at that again, and I send my message, he shall prepare the way before me. That is, that's Jehovah, that's God himself, that's going to do that, and the Lord, and that's the one whom you seek, that's the Messiah, will suddenly come to his temple, and the messenger of the covenant, whom you desire, behold, he cometh, set Jehovah a hope. So this one that comes is what? It's God in the flesh. It's deity itself. So the messenger of the covenant was as much God as God himself is. So for an individual, to me, it's pure infidelity. Now, for an individual to argue that Jesus was not God when he came into the world. And my favorite passage is Psalm 19, verse 2, when it speaks of God, he says, who is from everlasting to everlasting, that's eternal. But in Malachi 5, in verse 2, this governor that God's going to send, who's going forth off an oath from everlasting. So that means that Christ is as much everlasting as God is everlasting. God is eternal, but this governor that God's going to bring, he is from everlasting also. So if he's from everlasting and he doesn't change and he's eternal in the future, he's not going to play out in the future, he's eternal in the past, so that means then he is equally eternal as God is. So that position just as false as it can be, pure infidelity. I don't know why in the world that won't try to spend the time defending that, but that's what they're trying to do. So, well, I guess that's about the time, so. Well, we'll start there with that chapter next time. I'll finish that the next time, and I'll deal with John the Baptist down here in the last verse, verse 5, there, the Elijah that was to come. So I got myself kind of confused. I was from the Psalm. John the Baptist was the messenger. John the Baptist was the Elijah. We're going to show you that next time. We'll deal with that next time. Be thinking what you want to study. Let me know, and whatever you want to study, if you don't have any suggestion, I'll figure something out. But if you've got an idea, why, we'll try to follow classes.